All right, everybody. Thank you for attending session 164, titled The Poverty of Neurotheology, Why Recent Discoveries About the Brain Tell Us Nothing Conclusive About the Interface Between Religious Experience and Psychology. Our presenter is Paul Smith. He has a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Texas at Austin, with a concentration in philosophy of mind, consciousness, and philosophy of science. He also has a BA from BYU and an MS from the National Defense University, both in Middle Eastern studies. Paul's book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, was a Reader's Digest Editor's Choice and a featured book bonus selection. And let me just also remind you, if you haven't already done so, please turn off your cell phones. And the session is being recorded, and you can get a copy of the recording later if you'd like. Paul?
I'm right behind you. Thank you, and I apologize for the insanity. It's not at all Sunstone's or Nadine's fault. It's the fact of not starting out soon enough from Cedar City to get here. 2 seconds while I get this set. Come on. Oh, there we go.
We just found out we both live in Cedar City.
Yes, we'll have to get together for dinner or lunch or maybe even breakfast if I get up that early. Okay, good. So I think I have to stand here, but I also have to run my PowerPoint, so we'll see what happens.
Your screen just went away.
Oh, wonderful. HDMI. It thinks I have HDMI. Let me try this.
It's
searching.
I think I needed to tell it that it wants to communicate with a projector. Did that work?
Well, it was communicating.
I know it was, and all of a sudden it wasn't.
Yeah, maybe push that in.
It's in tight. There we go. Okay. If it stays here, we're good, right? Okay, so the poverty of neurotheology, why recent discoveries about the brain tell us nothing conclusive about the interface between religious experience and psychology. So, first off, let's talk about science and religion. In principle, I believe that there's no reason why religion in general and science in particular have to be at odds with each other. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't scientific facts that conflict with some religious doctrines and principles, and it certainly doesn't mean that scientists don't conflict with religionists, because they obviously do. One recent interesting attempt to explain religion in terms of science is a thing called, well, first of all, this little quote from Harold Whittison, who's actually an LDS scientist, social scientist. He said, "Since theologically based explanations for physical phenomena were such a basic impediment to scientific progress for thousands of years, it is not surprising that religion has therefore been almost universally dismissed by the scientific community as being irrational and unscientific." So how many have heard that kind of a sentiment expressed before? That's fairly common. Scientists often have a disdain for religion, and it kind of goes the other way often too, doesn't it? Okay, so a recent attempt to explain religion in terms of science, and hopefully by the people I think you're doing explaining, to help people who believe in religion feel a little bit better about being wrong, is a thing called neurotheology. So scientific observations have shown that things like epileptic seizures, stimulating with intense magnetic fields, stimulating the brain with intense magnetic fields, psychoactive substances of various descriptions, they can all have been shown to produce mystical or religious kinds of experiences in subjects. So, for example, there's studies that show that during meditation and certain kinds of religious worship, Buddhist priests, for example, have a certain kind of experience that can be... I think I lost my slide there. Okay. Certain kind of experience that can be observed in an fMRI and other kinds of brain imaging kinds of things. Okay. Experiments that have been used to manipulate the sensory environment of certain subjects have also been shown to give the experience kind of a dissociative experience where people feel like they are outside their bodies or whatever, kind of out-of-body experience done, however, in a very scientific sort of a way. Well, here we go. That's the second half of that slide. Okay, so the studies show that during meditation, activity in various brain areas, in this case, the parietal lobe, which is this right here, okay, lead to a kind of decreased sense of self, kind of a peak religious experience, a sort of mystical sort of occurrence in the person's mind. They kind of lose their orientation, as I say here, with space and time. So, and if you electrically stimulate another part of the brain, the right angular gyrus, you also get a sort of out-of-body kind of an experience. So, the question then becomes, do these kinds of religious and mystical experiences, including ESP, religion, religious experience, that kind of thing, spiritual experiences, if you will, are they essentially the result of a brain hiccup? That's kind of how it's looked at in these in this research. So an example, a scientist named Pigliucci, if we realize that mystical experiences originate from the same neurological mechanisms that underlie hallucinations from sensorial deprivation and drug-induced visions, I bet dollar to donut, so he's only willing to spend a dollar, I'd say dollars to donut, right? To donuts, that the reality experienced by meditating Buddhists and praying nuns is entirely contained in their mind and is not a glimpse of a higher realm, as tantalizing as that idea might be. Okay. And then Michael Persinger is kind of in the forefront of some of this research, including the deep cranial magnetic stimulation of various brain structures. He says, religion is a property of the brain, only the brain, and has little to do with what's actually out there. All right. So that's neurotheology. I want to talk about a bigger argument here. It's called the argument from physiology. Although, actually, I think it would be called the argument from neuroscience, because that's what it really relies on, is research into the central nervous system, brain functioning, that sort of thing. Other aspects of physiology don't really enter in here. All right, so a philosopher, Barbara Montero, says, the physiological argument claims that we have good inductive evidence for the view that the mind is fundamentally non-mental. That's a buzzword in philosophy for, in other words, physical. Okay, fundamentally non-mental, which is not something dualists can accept. Now, dualism, of course, is a term that refers to maybe mind being two elements. You've got the physical substrate on which the mind resides, and the mind itself is separate and a different kind of a thing than the physical is, and they kind of work together. Anybody here not familiar with the term dualism? Okay. So dualists have a real trouble, according to this author, with the supposed evidence from science. All right. And Jackson, another philosopher, it is widely believed that the physical scientist can, in principle, give a complete explanation for each and every bodily movement. In this regard, we do not differ from motor cars or plants. It is not plausible that in order to explain the behavior of a motor car, we need to go outside the resources of the physical sciences. And the same goes for the growth of plants. I will take it for granted that the same goes for us. Now, this is interesting because I think this is really the underlying thought process that's going on amongst what are known as physicalists. Physicalists are often scientists, often philosophers, often actually everyday folks who believe that the world only is physical or a consequence of physical facts. This is a physicalist interpretation. Of course, what Jackson doesn't tell you is that we actually haven't been able to define human behavior, human mentation in these terms. Science is working on it, but they've so far failed. So we still know more about motor cars and plants and how they work than we do about humans. All right. So there are three parts of the neuroscience argument. First one is what I call the absence of evidence argument. Okay. Essentially, neuroscience has never found any evidence for non-physical causes in the brain for any of these dualistic forces that are going on. All they've found is physical causes. Okay. Second, physiological problems, physiological deficits, as I say here, and manipulations. So when I say deficits, I'm talking about like brain diseases, lesions on the brain, brain injury, and such. Manipulations might be magnetic stimulation, might be the use of psychoactive drugs, that sort of thing. cause changes in brain function, which also changes a subjective experience. So in other words, you manipulate the brain in some way, whether it's through some psychoactive substance or through an injury or through some kind of stimulation, and you cause the person to have a different experience. They report having like these ideas being out of body or being mad when they're not really mad or whatever, right? So this, you go on and say brain injuries and diseases, psychoactive drugs, etc. I already explained that. All right. So for example, there's this condition known as visual agnosia. In visual agnosia, what happens is that the victim of this, and this is a brain disorder, this is a physiological disorder in the brain, can see normal things, can see images, can see objects and that kind of thing. They just don't have a way of hooking up the actual name of that object. You can show them something and they don't know what they're looking at. So some of the experiments they've done, for example, you don't need that right there. So for example, this experiment, this is kind of fun. Well, not for the person suffering from this, I guess, but the on the right, for example, with the key, That was the image that the sufferer from visual agnosia was supposed to sketch. And they sketch a quite good representation of it. But then when asked what this is, they say, I don't know what that is. You know, I sketched it. I don't know what it is. On the right, they sketch a pig. Now, all the rest of us know that's a pig, right? But this person didn't know. He thought, well, it at least recognizes an animal. Visual agnosia isn't always complete. It may be a partial deficit, right? So this person said, well, it could be a dog. I know it's an animal, that's the most they could say. The one on the bottom left, which we see as a bird picking on the ground, the sufferer with this problem sees a beach stump of some kind. It looks like driftwood, whatever. On the right, this is an interesting one. He says, well, I don't know exactly what it is. It's a wagon or a car of some kind. The larger vehicle is being pulled by the smaller one. I don't know if you can see that. They mistook this for another vehicle. So that kind of shows you how this can work, and that's a consequence of there being a lesion in the area that hooks up the name for something and the identity of something with the actual visual experience of seeing it. All right, so you can attribute all kinds of things to this, like mental illnesses or experiences with hallucinogens, right? And ultimately, the way the scientists look at this is if you can affect, by some physiological means, some physical means, if you can affect behavior, affect perception, if you can affect mental states, then that's evidence that the mind just is the brain. That is a physiological kind of a phenomenon that we attribute to being mind, belief, etc. Okay. So this model is kind of like the broken computer model, right? So you have a computer, it works fine until somebody starts messing with it. No, this is not one of my sons playing with that computer. And when, of course, the wrong thing gets monkeyed with or wears out or you get some kind of electrical feedback, then you get the blue screen of death, right? So that's kind of the model, if you want a metaphor for this idea. So there is another side to the story. Okay. Whoops. So to get there, I need to actually talk about a word, transduce. Anybody know what that is? Anybody not know what transduce is? I'm going to tell you in a minute. So good. I'm glad some of you don't know, so that makes my next slide not a waste. Okay. So transduce, to convert from one form to another, as from heat energy to electrical energy. And all kinds of things get transduced. So one example is sonar. Okay, so this is a guided missile destroyer, I guess. And this big bulb on the front end of this thing, that is a transducer, a sonar transducer. And its whole job is to turn electrical energy into sound energy, send that sound energy out through the water, bounces off a submarine or the bottom or whatever, bounces back, and then it turns that sound energy back into electrical energy. That's essentially what transduction is, okay? So how does that apply? I'd like to suggest the brain may be a transduction device. Then you say, well, what is it transducing, right? Well, let's talk about that. So the idea here is you can explain the mental phenomenon that you get when you do different things to the brain by also suggesting you're interrupting a signal of some sort. OK? Okay. So, for example, and we'll take religious experience because that's the main topic here. If religious experience does originate from outside the brain, from some, you know, different kind of domain or whatever, and then enters into the human mind in some way, if you were to mess with the brain, you would expect the signal to get garbled as well, right? I'm going to show some examples of that in a moment. So this doesn't apply just to religious experience. This argument with the idea of the physiological argument actually originally was applied to mental states and to consciousness in general. There's this movement in philosophy and science to want to discount consciousness as any really significant phenomenon. It's just something that's kind of a byproduct of the brain. And so what happens when you mess with the brain? You mess with this byproduct of the brain, and so you have weird states and that kind of thing. But it does, in this case, obviously apply to religious experience as well. All right. So one of the early proponents of this was Descartes, a philosopher, quite famous, who proposed the pineal gland as the transduction element. He didn't use that term, but he thought of the pineal gland for various reasons, including which he thought that it was the only gland in the body that only had one part of it. Everything else has two parts, like the brain itself, like the pituitary gland, like all of these other glands. There's two distinct elements to it. It turns out he was wrong about it. The pineal gland also has two parts to it. He just didn't have the instrumentation to show that. But he thought this might be the point between where the mind and the body and the brain connect, right? And he got a lot of grief for that, which we don't need to go into at this point, but nonetheless, that was really the first attempt to identify a physiological point for this. All right. So if we take this transduction idea and we assume just for the sake of the argument that there is some kind of a signal, whether consciousness or religious experience or whatever, and you think about the Mars rover. Okay, so the Mars rover is on Mars. And it's driving around, and let's just assume for the sake of the argument that there are Martians on Mars, okay? So this little green man or orange man or whatever color he might be, right? Or it could even be an orange or green female for all I know anyway, or maybe some other gender altogether, which doesn't exist here. So anyway, comes up and he sees this thing coming across. I'm going to use he because it's easier. Two letters, one syllable. Okay, so anyway, sees it coming across the terrain and it stops in front of him, and the little cameras go, you know, like that, and he looks at it, and he walks towards it, and it backs up, right? And he backs up, and it goes towards him, and it kind of goes around him, looks at him. But so to that Martian, that thing looks like it's an autonomous entity that is behaving all on its own, that is making decisions, it exercises volition, all that kind of thing. Okay, so that's what he believes in having this experience with this little lunar rover. We know the rover itself actually is being controlled from the little blue pearl that's sitting out there, the next planet in towards the sun, with a radio link. Now, I have to discount the transmission time here. This would not actually work physically, but for the sake of the metaphor, we'll let that go. So we know that this thing is getting actually orders and commands sent, that it isn't doing any thinking on its own. Now, that's not quite true. It does have onboard microprocessors that do make certain lower-level decisions and take certain actions that are programmed, allow it to do those kinds of things. But in general, the real seemingly intelligent behavior of this thing is driven by commands from outside of its little silicon brain. Okay. But notice we seem to have that same situation here. We seem to be autonomous entities walking around. We seem to, based on what science tells us, that everything that we need to function and to make decisions and behave is all up here in our heads, right? That's all there is. You shut down the brain, you shut down behavior instantly. That's the way it works, okay? But the fact of the matter is, observing from the outside, you can't tell the difference between whether you're being, have the signal coming in, there's a non-local mechanism coming in, or whether it's all there. My own personal opinion is we're kind of like smart terminals where we have certain physical things going on in our brains that control immediate kinds of things going on here. But there is also then this non-local, as I'm going to call it, non-local component coming in. Non-local is kind of borrowed from quantum physics, where the idea is that you get photons entangled and they can, and they, one affects the other without any cause. Well, this is, as far as science is concerned, if there is a signal like that, it's non-local in that it doesn't seem to have a physical cause going on, right? So I'll use that term, non-local. So I think that we have probably a little of both going on. I think we do have, like a smart terminal, a computer, it's got its own resident memory and software, but it also gets influenced by the mainframe, by the server or whatever it is that's running that terminal as well. And both, it interacts with the machine, and the machine also goes through its own routines as well. Okay. All right. So, in this model, you think of the brain as a TV set. It took a long time to find one that old. TV set, all right? So, and TV set, of course, at least the old kind, had a lot of tubes and stuff in it. This would apply even to the new ones, but it's really not impressive looking in the back of a new one. All it is these printed circuits, right? So I wanted one with tubes. So we have this TV set with tubes. And if you pull one of those tubes out, what happens? Something happens, right? Something happens. It may be you get a distorted picture. If a tube fails, I mean, the TV repair guy used to come over to my house when I was really little, when I was, well, before most of you guys were born. I won't say all of you, but most of you guys were born, right? They come over, the TV would look like that, he'd switch out some tubes, and then it would look right again. So, or maybe you kind of lose the picture altogether, and you just get these weird patterns. That's what the TV does on its own, right? If you don't have transmission coming in, the TV does have certain appearance on the screen might show, but it's totally unintelligible. There's no information being transmitted, right? Or it can be something absolutely weird altogether. How do you like that one? Yeah, I was talking about psychedelic drugs. That's pretty darn close, right? Okay, so a television set is a receiver, right? And by tweaking certain parameters, you can make it behave just as if it were, you know, if somebody watching TV. So someone from, I don't know, the 11th century watching a TV would think all of that stuff was in the TV itself. In fact, there are stories of indigenous folks seeing a TV for the first time, wondering how they got all those old people in there, right? So if you didn't know any better, you'd think that TV set was self-containing. And yet it's not. Because when you tweak things, you affect how the signal gets translated and you get weird behavior from your TV, just like you do with people, right? Okay, I say this just like any other human-created information device, including a computer. If you think about it, a computer, just about anything in a computer that's meaningful at all came from the outside, ultimately. Now, it can do operations on that and come up with unique combinations, but it can only do that when it has information inputted from the outside, but which makes it a little difficult for the computer model for the people who, the neurotheologians, if you will. Okay, so tweaking component in television affects the image by distorting, disrupting, or preventing reception of the broadcast signal. And if we extrapolate this to the brain, mood disorders might be a function of this. The underlying physical mechanism gets messed up, and so our normal personality, our normal consciousness gets distorted or warped in some way, right? Personality disorders. I don't know why Jack Nicholson is all the crazy movies. Anybody got any idea why that is? Maybe so good at it. I don't know. Anyway, okay, so, and psychoactive substances, same thing, in effect maybe the transmission mechanism for consciousness, religious behavior, whatever. So you can think of it this way. The brain makes the body run, but might it also be a receiver and a transmitter for some aspect? I put this in parentheses because, as I said, I'm not sure everything that happens in our minds necessarily comes from outside, right? But for at least some aspect of spirit, if you will, or consciousness. So, if you don't have evidence for that particular proposition, that the brain is a transducer, if you don't have evidence for a non-local signal, there isn't any reason to suppose that mind and subjective religious experience is any more than the workings of the brain. Without some kind of countervening evidence, the physical evidence is going to be what rules the day, right? Okay. Yes.
Unless you could identify the comm link,
uh-huh,
physical comm link, and turn it off, and then the signal stops.
Yeah.
right?
Yes, which would be great, but we haven't done that yet, right? And in fact, what a brain scientist or a neuroscientist, most of them would tell you is, well, all you've done is affect the mechanism that regulates personality or consciousness in the brain. You know, what we've done is identified where the personality is, right? That's what they tell you, right? And who knows? I mean, you might find that kind of a center that controls personality in the brain, but it also might be a transducer, but without knowing what the signal is or knowing that there is a signal, you wouldn't be able to identify that, right? So what I want to say, there is such evidence, okay? And this is, I'm not going to argue this is controversial, but it's controversial for mainly because science doesn't want to accept it for reasons we can talk about maybe in the Q&A. Okay, so I'm going to talk about two experimental paradigms at the moment that produces evidence, but there are numerous others, and a little bit later I'll just mention briefly what some of those are. Okay, so the first one is presentiment. Has anybody heard of the presentiment experiments? No one? New terrain to mine. Okay, great. Presentiment. Okay, the idea in the presentiment experiment is you have a bunch of images loaded in a computer which will randomly select from this pool of images. Some of these images are pleasant, such as this scene from Hawaii, right? Some of them are pleasant. Some of them are terrifying, okay? And it might be spiders, it might be cadavers, it might be actually dissection scenes, as some of these images are. They're designed to be really shocking, right? So you have the pleasant images, and you have the shocking images. And what they find, what you do is you sit down there and you click, and the computer goes clump, 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 and decides which picture it's going to show. Okay, it doesn't even decide whether it's a scary picture or a pleasant picture. It just picks one randomly from its database, portrays it on the screen. In the meantime, you see this young lady. She's got her fingers wired up. And in this case, it's a skin conductance measuring device, right? So the interesting thing is that our nervous systems are, of course, attuned to react to shocking, scary things. I mean, that's part of the survival thing. If you don't react to a shocking, scary thing, you're probably going to get killed before you even know it, right? So we're designed to jump out of the way of the taxi cab or spot the leopard that's about to leap, for those of you who are into paleo. Anyway, that's the way we're wired to react to that. What's interesting is if you hook somebody up to some autonomic response, such as your skin conductance or heart rate or blood volume, blood pressure, these different kind of measures that are governed by your autonomic nervous system, which actually is almost the first to react in event of a threat, you see interesting result in that before the pleasant images, you essentially have no reaction. But before the shocking images, up to 6 seconds before the shocking images, autonomic nervous system will react, sometimes quite startlingly. Okay, and this research has been done numerous times. There are 26 studies from 7 different laboratories that were done. A meta-analysis was done of the results. There were a total of 40 studies, but only 26 of them were similar enough to meet the criteria for meta-analysis, and they discovered that they were significant to p is less than 2.7 times 10 to the minus 12. Now, I'm not smart enough with statistics to tell you what the odds against chance are there, but it's in the millions, right? These are not odds you'd take if you were trying to win the Powerball, okay? This is such a tiny chance that this was accidental, that this result is accidental, that it is essentially conclusively highly, highly, very highly statistically founded, okay? And there's research like this going on. So we're talking about a paradigm, an ESP-based paradigm, because remember, this is backwards in time, something you shouldn't be able to do if the physicalists are right. Shouldn't be able to do backwards in time, and it has been verified and continues to be replicated. Okay, how many have heard that in the news? You have, okay. That tells you how enthusiastic the media is about this. Okay. All right. The next one I'm going to talk about is remote viewing, and that's something I'm very familiar with. So this is from one of the founders of the remote viewing program that the military set up starting in 1972. He explains remote viewing as direct awareness or experience of distant locations or events in space and time that are blocked from ordinary perception by distance, shielding, or time, and generally considered to be secure from such access by any known physical means or by means of logical inference. In other words, he's trying to cover all the bases here, but essentially this is an extrasensory sort of effect, right? Sense of computer. It's an extrasensory perception sort of an effect. And the way you certify that is by excluding any possible way of getting information other than the powers of the mind itself. Okay. And as you'll see, this has been a very successful paradigm. All right. So remote viewing is a form of extrasensory perception. It's usually done under double-blind conditions in secured circumstances. In other words, particularly in a research environment, you put the subject in a room and there's no possible way for any kind of sensory leakage to get in. And they have to remote view if they're going to produce any information at all that's accurate. All right? It produces both prima facie, in other words, observable, unmistakable kinds of results, and statistical results as well, and I'll talk about both of those here in a moment. It seems to be an ability common to most humans. In their research, they found almost no one who couldn't do it to some degree. That means every one of you guys out there is psychic in a certain way. I know you don't believe that, or maybe you didn't realize that. Some of you, how many here think you're psychic? How many won't admit that you're psychic? Okay, good. Thank you. All right. So, and remote viewing makes no metaphysical assumptions as to its causal history. This is very important. If somebody tells you that they're a remote viewer and they have spirit guides to help them, that's not remote viewing. If they tell you that you're channeling, that's not remote viewing. If they need a crystal ball, that's not remote viewing. I'm not going to pass judgment on all the particular kinds of disciplines. But the fact of the matter is, remote viewing is essentially just the facts, ma'am. We're going to do it. We're going to show the result. We're going to measure it as well as we can scientifically. We're not going to make any commitment as to how it happens. We don't know. Okay, there is research into trying to figure it out, but it's all science-based. There's some suspicion it might be tied in with quantum entanglement. I think there's some issues with that, but we won't go into right now. Okay, so here's some prima facie remote viewing results. So remember, this is done double blind. These are all done fully blind. The viewer doesn't know what the target is. That's what we call the subject, is the viewer, right? The remote viewer. They don't know what the target is. They're presented an arbitrary number that in a kind of complicated explained way is linked to the nature of the target in a way that they can't get any information about it. Okay, and so the idea is that they sketch the target that number stands for, okay, sketch and describe it verbally, and then at the end you compare it. And there are criteria to match, and you can do statistics on the matching and all that kind of thing, right? So here's one, here's the person, okay. Now I can tell you about this one because I did this one, all right? So that was a sketch I came up with. No idea what the target was, but that was the target. Am I got to get out of the way? Can you see it?
So how does the situation, so, they gave you just like a number?
They just gave me a number. Mm-hmm.
Like what number did they give you?
I don't know. It was a number, right? A number. And there's, like I said, a complicated explanation of why we think this works, right? But you do not want the viewer to know anything about the target up front. You want to eliminate that possibility altogether. Not just because that means they could cheat, right? But it actually messes up remote viewing. Because if they already know what the target is, then they're going to get what is in their head already. Things they know about the target, things they can guess about the target, and they're not going to get stuff they don't know about the target because it'll be blanked out by all this other stuff. So you absolutely want them to be blind for them to be successful at this, in this behavior. Okay, so here's another one. So I don't know how well you can see those. What would you guess the target was from those images?
Waterfall.
Yeah, and actually that was the target, Blue Nile Falls. Now, let me tell you something about this. These were done by three different viewers in three different years, okay? And yet they all came up with their own variations of the same thing, right?
So,
yes.
Sorry, so I'm not picturing how the study's happening. So somebody just tells you a number, and it's the person who's telling you the number looking at that picture?
Okay,
so
in a fully scientific approach to this, right? You may have somebody in there helping you, but they're blind as well.
Right, meaning they're not looking at
it. They're not only are they not looking at it, they have no idea what it is.
Okay.
They're completely in the dark, just like you, the viewer, are. And no one involved with the experiment is allowed to see what it is until after it's all over. Then you give them feedback, right? So when the viewers were done, they would get this picture to tell them what it was that they were targeting.
Okay.
Okay.
So is there just a voice on an intercom that says number
two? Well, they might give the hand the number to the, as we call them, the monitor or the interviewer, right? But so the number might be 8675309.
Okay.
Okay. I didn't hear. The number is like a ready, set, go. Okay, it's kind of like a ready, set, go. And there's a opinion, shall I say, a belief, that in some way that number is linked to the intent of the tasker, who is in a double blind situation, not even associated with the viewer until after things are done, right? So I'll explain that at greater length later. Okay.
That just helped me to picture the what's happening in the room.
Yes. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Good. Yes. There is one question back there.
Presumably, over 3 years, there will be a lot of people exposed to this target. What percentage of people here,
You know, I don't know how many people work this. I think you're going to a thing called the stacking effect, where if you have 10,000 people work a target, some of them are accidentally going to get the right thing, right? This is far too few. I can't tell you how many, but it would be in the probably less than a dozen over that period of time. Okay, so it's very unlikely that you'd get a stacking effect here.
Were you prepared in any way? You know, like, did you know what you were going through? Did they just put you in a room and
said? So I'll tell you what. You probably had a whole question until I get done, all right? But I recognize you've got a question, and you have one too, okay? All right, so here's another one. This time, instead of a sketch, the viewer is asked to do a three-dimensional model of the target. This guy was really good. He's actually still really good, right? And that was the target. Yeah. Okay. I really like this water tower here. He got it there, although it's not in exact proportion. Can you see it if I'm out of the way? Okay, all right. This is another one I did. I had no idea what the target was. And what it turned out to be was the Beijing Bird's Nest Stadium. And there was even a time element in this one. It was during the opening night with all the fireworks. And like I said, when I was doing this, I had no idea what I was doing, right? I just did what felt right. I knew there was something that was round. And then I did this here, which I figure must have been fireworks. I don't know, you know. At least I don't know why I put it there, and it looks kind of like fireworks. So, and this, of course, this up here in the corner too. So, anyway, okay. So, and here's some statistics on it. These are various different experiments. So, this is the first one. The Paralab closed down about 5 years ago, but they did 25 years somewhat of research. In 653 trials, they came up with a highly statistically significant effect. That's really hard to say, almost as bad as subliminal perception. But anyway, P equals 3 times 10 to the minus 8, which, as I recall, works out to about 1 chance in 300 million that this was an accident. So that's pretty high odds there. So, of course, the military did this, and the Congress ordered them to do a review of all of the research they did up until 1988, and they found in all their records 25,449 remote viewing trials in a couple hundred experiments. I don't remember the exact number. And you get, they get these astronomical odds here, right? P equals 6.12 times 10 to the minus 14. I mean, that's huge. That's absolutely huge. Now, this is interesting. This is a different way of approaching remote viewing called associative remote viewing, which allows you to predict the outcome of a future binary event. So, will will BYU or the Utes win the game, right? Or any other sports team of your choosing, or stock price go up or down, whatever. This guy, Greg Kolodziejczyk, yeah, I don't know how he gets that pronunciation out of that, but he does. You probably still can't see that slide, can you? He wanted to play with this, and so he set up an impeccable experiment. It was just him and a computer. And the thing with ARV is that you actually have money on the line, so your best interest is to actually do this right. So he did 5,677 trials over, I think it was 11 years, and his statistics were P equals 3.2 times 10 to the minus 5, which is a huge effect. And he netted, this is not gross, this is netted $147,000 doing the commodity futures. That was his target. He did 5,677 trials against oil and pork bellies and grain and corn. I don't know what all it was, right? But he actually made that money. So people say, well, if you're psychic, why aren't you rich? Well, use an ARV, you might be able to become rich, okay? My own son, not this one back here, but my middle son, was at the University of Colorado and decided in his science class that to try an associated remote viewing experiment. They got some seed money from there was this dot-com millionaire who was auditing the class, and so he kicked in $10,000, you know, seed money, and said, well, if you lose it, I'm not going to charge you for it, but if you make money, I get to keep it. Okay. Well, he got $16,000. At the end of 7 trials, all of them correct. The statistics are significant, but not huge, because, of course, you know, didn't have that many trials, but still a significant effect. They netted $16,000, and if they had not violated their protocol, they would have actually netted almost twice that. They got greedy, and that's one of the rules in ARV, is you follow the protocol or you lose money. And they got greedy and sat on the issue that they had for too long, and it started to drop, and then they panicked and sold. But if they had sold when they were supposed to, they would have netted somewhere around, I think, around 25K, something like that. So, anyway.
It's a good lesson to learn about someone else's money.
Yes, good thing it was somebody else's money, yeah. Okay, so here's some other forms of, you know, experimental paradigms that are used in the ESP world, scientific parapsychology, I often call it. Direct mental interaction with living systems, associated remote viewing, I talked a little about. Gonsfeld is another one, and there are many others. Okay, so it isn't just the first two that are producing this evidence. There is a ton, literally ton. I know that's a scientific sounding term, but there is a ton of evidence out there that supports this non-local signal, at least in terms of mental states and consciousness. Okay, so they all demonstrate that mind seems able to extend beyond the body. That seems pretty clear if you can describe a waterfall that's on the other side of the globe from you using all the power of your mind. That seems to indicate that mind is more than just the physical substrate of the brain. It seems reasonable to at least entertain the idea that the brain can function as a receiver transmitter for some non-local, as yet unidentified non-local signal. It's also reasonable to think that at least some aspects of religion or spirituality are not brain hiccups after all, right? But they're actually real things come in from some other domain that can affect our brains and be affected by our brains. Okay, that doesn't. When you look at this evidence and you look at the evidence that the scientific community is trying to present for the other side, you see that that doesn't actually trump this idea of non-physical kinds of mental interactions, be it religious, conscious, or whatever. So, recapitulating the physicalist argument. So, apparent religious states can be duplicated through brain or sensory manipulation. There's no evidence for any external signal that might cause religious experience. Therefore, all these kinds of subjective states, religious experience, consciousness states, that kind of thing, are real, but only experientially real. Okay, they're really nothing more than the central nervous system malfunctioning or behaving in a strange or different kind of a way. All right, so the dualist rebuttal, if you will. Okay, the fact that brain manipulations can cause apparent duplication of these religious or mental states is inconclusive for this particular reason, is that if there is such thing as a transduction model for the brain and the mind, okay, the brain itself would naturally have elements in it, structures, features, whatever, that would be there to translate this non-local signal, which doesn't directly interact with physical, into physical material, or into phenomena that can be manipulated by the brain, so that we can talk about it, so we can draw sketches about it, so that we can think about it, that kind of thing, okay? So, what that means is that neural manipulation, in other words, going in and poking some part of somebody's brain and having them have an out-of-body experience, right? Okay, that only mimics what happens when that particular part of the brain actually receives one of these signals and then transduces it into an actual physical experience of some kind. Okay, so all you're doing is essentially, it's like putting a test load on a TV. The TV signal normally makes the TV work, but you can go in and hook up a testing device that will send a signal to the TV tube artificially. It's no longer an actual TV signal, it's just a testing device, right? That's kind of how a transductionist, if you will, might argue against that, right? So, of course, without evidence of that signal existing, this non-physical signal existing, then we don't have any reason to consider it. Yet there is evidence, it's ESP evidence, and therefore we have good reason to think, at least not to reject the transductionist kind of a model. All right, two quotes and then I'm getting into questions. All right, so John Fowles, one of my favorite authors, I don't know if you ever read The Magus, but that's an awesome book, okay? Verification is the only scientific criterion of reality. That does not mean that there may not be realities that are unverifiable. And, whoops, too far, Blaise Pascal, there are, that's probably not how you say it because it's French, but anyway, there are two equally dangerous extremes, to shut reason out and to let nothing else in. Okay, so since my company is paying for the trip, I do have to put up the advertising. If you want to know more about remote viewing, go to my website. You can read my two books. One, Reading the Enemy's Mind, has been out since 2005. The other one isn't quite out. I hope to have it out by the end of August. So thank you. I appreciate your attention. And now we can... did you want to manage? No. Go ahead. Yes.
So I think it's absolutely incredible that you didn't have a respondent for this presentation.
Uh-huh.
A. B, there's no department on Earth that would allow you to say anything like this in the context of a philosophy of mind PhD. So let me just run through some...
Although there was one that did.
That's amazing. let's just start with your false dichotomy between a receiver model and a physicalist slash eliminist model.
Okay.
That somebody like Dennis...
Oh, okay, sorry. Oh, they got to come to the mic.
Do you want to do questions now, or do you want to finish your presentation?
I'm done.
You're all done? Okay.
Yeah, okay.
All right. So, for the tape, could you come up and certainly speak into the mic?
I would love to. All right. This mic?
Well, we could use one of these.
We don't know if they're on. Go ahead and use this one.
Is
it? Okay.
I turned it off.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, the dichotomy between a transducer model of mind and a physicalist model of mind is a false one. I think somebody with your degree should know that Daniel Dennett, that David Chalmers and Paul Frege actually promote an argument that allows for separate mental properties being in matter and explaining consciousness without any sort of outside signal.
Right.
Actually, this solves all of the problems that you set up, and you failed to mention that in your presentation, which is a pretty serious failure, I think.
First, being late, and second of all, having a lot to say. First of all, Chalmers, yes, I've read his book. I know him, actually. We've had some conversation and stuff. He's got a local non-physical model, right? He still accepts non-physicalism as part of the brain function, right, and part of the mind, actually contributing to mind. The problem with his argument is that all of his arguments for his local non-local model, if you will, right, also support this model. That you can't discriminate between the two models based on his evidence.
His model is much more parsimonious than yours. A. B, you've hitched this model of mind onto something extremely implausible like remote viewing, which is extremely contested. So it seems to me a pretty bad argument if you need to go to something that's...
So the contesting, of course, is more of a popularity contest. If you get into Kuhnian dialectics, you will discover that in fact the contesting of this data is largely driven by an old guard mentality. I just cited some of the evidence for it. And, a typical skeptic will say, oh, well, that's first of all, selective reporting, file drawer effect, confirmation bias, and so on, right? Well, all of those things have been controlled for in this research. Over time, over the last 20 years, skeptics have not kept up with the progress in parapsychology. And in fact, Richard Weissman himself, said that by all standards of modern science, parapsychology would be proved. But because he adheres to Marcello Truzzi's dictum that you have to have extraordinary evidence to support an extraordinary claim, it's only extraordinary in terms of the actual mentality of the current scientific paradigm, right? It's only extraordinary in those counts. But in order to overcome that, you have the extraordinary evidence. Well, in fact, I argue we have the extraordinary evidence. It's just as being rejected because it violates the paradigm that's being promoted in the modern scientific community.
Well, you can have the last word on that one. the other one that I'd say is retrocausality is possibly compatible with physicalism, which I think is something that you should have tagged. And the other thing that I would say is the p-values that you presented made it look like the number of trials were your sample size or something like that. So it's pretty much impossible for anybody here to really trust.
No, I agree. And it's and my guidance is to go check out the research yourself. I can't present all of that in one talk, so I didn't. I just gave an example, a general overview. So. Okay.
Well, if anyone has any more questions,
yes, ma'am. You get a microphone. Yes, come on.
I think
it won't be on the tape. If you don't get on the mic, it won't be on the tape.
Ask your question here, so we'll put it on the tape.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the point. It isn't so that everybody can hear you; it's so that it gets recorded. So.
I feel extremely skeptical as well. And I think we should do an experiment right in this room with your images. And if we could,
you've already seen them.
I'll give you a number.
Yep.
I will be glad to do it right here in this room under these circumstances if you will do the double slit experiment for me right now. This is not a scientific experiment to just do a one-off ad hoc experiment. I would be happy to submit to an experiment if you want to set one up. I'll even come up back up here to Salt Lake if you want to set one up. But doing one just ad hoc here in the group actually proves nothing. Even if I got it right, it wouldn't prove anything.
Amazing, Randy already set up your experiment. Go win $1 million.
What?
If you can remote, you can win $1 million.
First of all, it doesn't exist anymore. That's been taken down. And second of all, you have to see what the conditions are. And you might change your mind about it being a reasonable experiment. Okay, yes, ma'am.
Let me post something that's very simple because I'm a very simple person.
Mm-hmm.
But here's an example of where I'm coming from. When I was doing my internship in my field, I had a chronic schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the symptom that so many people suffer from, of bugs crawling all over him, communication. So he was telling me, back in the Three Speech Days in Berkeley, he was sitting in People's Park, and he felt that, he learned to ignore that. He felt that sensation. And after a while, he looked down and he was sitting next to an anthill. So, if I like to be a believer, I'm not a true believer like Eric Hawker was, but that it's plausible that our brains can act as transmitters, transduce signals, and that, but the problem would be how do we differentiate the morphology in the brain? Say we have complex partial seizures, which is associated with hyperreligiosity or some kind of psychosis, and suppose we have an EEG and it can measure, it can show us the person is having an epileptic seizure. Still, that doesn't say to me that someone isn't receiving something. It would be, how do we sort out flecks of gold from the
And that's a huge problem. I frankly think there's a lot of room for research in all kinds of elements, in lots of different elements and aspects of all of this. There is some research done on ESP contribution to mental illness, and I'm not familiar with it, and I don't know how rigorous it is. But, you know, it's hard to say that. That's something that needs to be disentangled and worked on, but of course there's no funding for parapsychology research, so you know, if you want to do it on your own. Okay. Yes. I think, when are we done?
I think,
last this might have to be the last question.
Last question. We started a little late, so.
Yeah. Whose fault was that?
I'm a late person myself, so I don't judge that. I just wanted to say, make a comment. I appreciate your sense of your sense of humor in this, and your ability to articulate and speak. I can't just stand by and say that I approve of the way that you presented your opposing view. An opposing view is completely acceptable. You were a little more respectful, except at the end when you wanted to invite a test. That's great. There could just be a little more. Peer respect. Your energy is wonderful. I just think you might want to moderate the respect aspect in the way that you try to speak as a peer. So I just didn't want to sit by and not speak up about it.
Well, thank you. Well, that's the first time I've had questioners actually get reviewed by somebody. But yeah, I appreciate that. I actually don't take offense to this. I've actually had much more vociferous and obnoxious people challenge me, and I actually welcome the interchange. So, anyway.
Do you have any final words?
Thank you for coming, and I appreciate it.